met Marshall last January when I was in La Paz at the headquarters of the United Farm Workers. And I found out that Marshall, I knew that Marshall's home was in Washington, but I found out he was out here, so I spoke to him and he consented to come and both explain to us some of the outline, what the union is, and then try to get into and explain some more of the issues that the farm workers are dealing with and why they're there. So that introduction, Marshall.
Thank you, Mark. Mark, when he wrote me, he said he realized that I wasn't a professional speaker, and I'm not. As a matter of fact, this will be a first for both of us. If I mumble, you can't understand me, don't tell me, you'll embarrass me. There's several aspects of we call La Causa. La Causa is the cause or the movement. And the union, as a union, is one aspect of it. There's social aspects, there's business aspects, religious, and political. I've broken them down to several different headings, and I'll try to touch on most of them. I probably won't get them all. But of course, we have a reason for the union. Why should we have one? We have a slight history of the present union, and some of the different aspects of the union, strikes, reasons for strikes, boycott tactics, agribusiness, politics, the church involvement, and as well as the politics involved with the church. Within the church, we have investigations by the federal government, state governments, media. Something that was in the headlines for a long time was the Teamsters and the Teamster conflict. What the media has done for us and to us, you have education of the people within the union, say, let's say more the staff workers, then we have education of the farm workers. We have La Paz, which is the administrative headquarters. Originally, it was intended to be a retreat similar to Holden Village here, but it has since become the administrative headquarters of the union. And lastly, and certainly not leastly, is the nonviolence and Caesar's total dedication to nonviolence. Okay, let's get back to the first one. Some of the reasons for the union. Many of you here may have read that book by John Steinbeck, The Grapes of Wrath, and while reading it, thought, well, that was, you know, way back in the 30s, and depression and all that, you know, it was terrible days. And we don't stop to think or realize that those very same days exist for people right now today. They existed in 1960 when Caesar finally started forming the union. And those very same conditions exist today somewhere in the United States. So that was one of the big reasons. It's just total exploitation of the people. Exploitation by the growers, playing the people against one another with the aid of the federal government. At that time, we had the Bracero program where growers were allowed to bring people from Mexico under contract and put them up in their grower-provided housing and they would work the fields. The only thing was that prior to them having brought the people over, they were supposed to have used up all the local help that was available, but they never did that. What they would do, they would contract the braceros and bring them in and put them to work, and then all your local people would be out there looking for jobs, but there weren't any jobs available because they were already taken up by the braceros. So they were doing it in reverse. And your state and federal bureaus that were supposed to be governing this were going with the growers. They would say, no, you have to go over there and fill out a card and ask for a job. Okay, you go out there and fill out a card and ask for a job. Well, no, there were no jobs because they were all taken up. So it was just working in reverse. It was the tail wagging the dog. And then aside from that, we had tremendous exploitation by the labor contractors. They'd go out, get the people, take them out to the camps, put them to work, and after weeks of working, if the guy was lucky, he'd get a little bit of money. He wouldn't end up owing the growers money. They would charge him for their food, charge him for rent, sell them soap, just your regular things you need every day, and at exorbitant prices. And so many times people would go back owing money, or just come out even. Oftentimes they would get, say, illegals and take them out to the camps, and just within a few days of the picking season being done, they'd call in the immigration, whip them all up, send them back to Mexico, and the contractor and the grower would end up with all the money. Okay, so there was a need. There was a need. But probably the biggest need was just the simple thing of recognizing these people that are working in your fields as human beings. Human beings who had a right to an honest living. You know, they were working for it, trying to get it, but they were just getting ripped off every time they turned around. By everybody, by the grower, by the government, federal, state, county. By the people that they were putting their contracts in, with. Every time they turned around. And I'm not talking about just a little instance here and there. I mean, we're talking about millions and millions of dollars. There had been many efforts to organize the farm labor in California, well, all over the United States for that matter. But in California, because of the power, political, which got right back down to money, they were always crushed, because anytime the grower was in trouble, he'd call the state police or the county sheriff, somebody else, and they'd run the strikers out of town, incarcerate them, physically abuse them, in many cases send them to jail, whatever. So they were always crushed. In about 1958, is when I became involved with the farm worker organization, with a group called the Agricultural Workers Association. Now, at this time, Cesar and Dolores Huerta, Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, were very heavily involved in CSO. Cesar, at this point, was national director. But we had gotten word that finally the AFL-CIO was willing to look at organizing the farm worker. And so we organized the Agricultural Workers Association in Stockton, California. And along about 6 months down the line, we got word that they were sending a representative from the AFL-CIO, Norm Smith, to see what we had, if we were a viable organization, if there was the spirit needed to go ahead with organizing the union. So Norm Smith came down. He looked at us, saw what we had. We had our meeting at St. Mary's Hall, which was a hall about four times as big as this. It was packed with farm workers. He saw what we had. He liked it. At that point, he says, okay, we're from the AFL-CIO. We have the funds to back you. We will be willing to. All we ask is that you give us your intent to merge with us. At that meeting, we did take that vote, and of course, it was a positive vote because essentially we were broke. All we had was people. And we made the motion carried to merge with AFL-CIO. I pretty well dropped out of it at that time because I felt, well, here we have the biggest, greatest union organization in the world. They must know how to do it. As it turned out, they didn't. They spent a lot of money, several million dollars, as AWOC, Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee. And but they were working, trying to organize as you would organize a factory or a plant, and couldn't do that. The man who had the key at this time was Cesar Chavez, and he was still working with the CSO, but down the line he quit his national directorship of CSO and went down to Delano and formulated his plan for organizing. Now we have to take a comparison here of who Cesar Chavez is. He's a Mexican American. He had about $300 in the bank. He had four kids at this point, I think, and an old car. Physically, that's all he had, and he was opposing the largest industry in the United States, in California. In 1967, they had a $4.6 billion a year. Now, you couldn't hardly even say David and Goliath. Caesar had nothing. Well, he had three things. He was right. He knew he was right. He had the faith. He had the courage to go ahead and do it. And he took some of his lessons from CSO and went contacting the people and talking to the people, asking them, not telling them what they needed, asking them what they needed. See, that was one of the things about the grower's attitude towards the workers is this grand paternalism. I know what my people need. I take care of them. I know what the families need. They always come back to me. They have to be there year after year. They have got no place else to go. But Caesar went, worked with the people, met with them, and pretty quick, he had all the ballot. The one thing he didn't have was money. See, AWOC was getting money from AFL-CIO. In 1959, They had spent about $1 million and still didn't have a reasonable group, not for that kind of money. Caesar had spent, probably $500 or $600 out of his money, and everything else was just what people were giving him. But he would go to a person's home in the evening, have a house meeting, and maybe stay there and eat off them overnight. And so people were relating to him. They knew where he was coming from. They knew where he had been. So, yeah, then we get down to the union. We know that there's a need for the union. And just say a little background there of where Caesar came from. But one of the greatest needs is for somebody to recognize you, that you are in fact in existence and are representing somebody. And this was probably the greatest fight, because until somebody recognizes you and is willing to negotiate with you, no, you're nothing. Okay, because of this lack of the growers to recognize his existence, or that he had these people behind him, it led to the strikes. And the strikes get right back to what we were talking about earlier. We have wages. I'm going to read them off because I don't know how many union people there are in here, but there are the standard things. But when we're talking about wages for the farm worker, we're not talking about like what at that time some people were used to, like $4, $5, $6 an hour. We're talking about machine operators. Now, here's a man who was driving a machine, is expected to take care of the machine, and doing the work of probably 30 laborers, hand laborers, doing getting $1.25 an hour. That's the type of thing. When we're talking about wages, we're talking about wages. Work conditions, which is one of the key items. We have a history of pesticide sickness. People being sent into fields to pick probably 12 hours after pesticides have been sprayed. Farm workers have one of the highest mortality rates in the United States. Another interesting thing is, real often, if you ever look up any labor statistics, you'll always notice that they say farm labor is not included, because they don't take these things. They either want to hide them or they're ashamed of them. But you've got people 40 years old, no longer being able to work because their bodies have been bent out of shape. We have this, what they call a short-handled hoe. Now, many jobs can be done just as well with a long-handled hoe. Some jobs actually do require the short-handled, but it's a little jobby by yay long, and you to do your work, you have to walk long all day like that. That's great for Sunday gardening or Saturday shot, but when you're making your life at it, doing 10, 12 hours a day, when you're getting up there 30, 35, 40 years old, you're in really bad shape, and you've got nowhere to go. At one time, you had no state compensation, no state recognition as a laborer, as a worker. Camps, getting back to our Grapes of Wrath job, the camps are a disgrace. people literally treated their dogs better than they treated their camp workers. Have two-room shacks or one-room shacks for 8, 10, 12 people. And if an extra family happened to come in, well, you know, you'd bunk in with that other family because we ain't got no more room. Outside latrines, within 8 or 10 feet of the living quarters, no running water. And what water was down the tap a half mile was cold water. No facilities at all, no health care. And again, your county or your state would not enforce what health regulations there were. I'm saying this about California, but the situation also exists here in Washington and Oregon. It exists in every state that has farm workers today. Not just then, but today. And of course, a farm worker had no job security. At any time that the boss or the foreman or the contractor didn't like whatever you were doing, or what's more, any complaints you had to lodge against your treatment, that was it. Goodbye. So you had to take it, or you left. If you left, either way, you know, if you stayed, you lived in misery. If you left, you didn't eat. Your family didn't. Of course, in today's world, many of us who have worked around unions, or we take the fringe benefits for granted. Things like pensions, health and welfare, just social services that you get from a union, you know, we just take them for granted. They were unheard of for farm workers. Today, they are still unheard of in many areas. And the government, and I'm talking about the federal, state, your county, and your local government attitude toward the farm worker has always been one of ignoring them until they become trouble. If they become trouble, then do something to get rid of them. The state government, by ignoring them, was maybe gave them a little incentive to get out into the next state or the next county where they wouldn't have a basis for the complaint that they're filing here. The federal government, of course, like I was saying, through their Bracero program, held down the farm worker for years. As a matter of fact, it was because of UFW's political involvement that we were able to get rid of the Bracero program. Many people have thought in the past that he was pushing to keep it, to get the Mexicans in. See, that's another thing. They've consistently tried to make it a racist issue. It's not a farm worker, it's not a labor issue, it's a Mexican. Which is another question that we should get into. Why not now? Jim brought out that deal there about the, that came out in the National Geographic. Yes, there are a lot of Mexicans in farm work. As a matter of fact, there's more than a million people in farm work as farm laborers. They don't know for sure. It's another one of those little statistics that they don't keep real good track of. But like in Florida, where farm workers do have a contract with the Coca-Cola company, with two citrus companies back there, and they're mostly blacks. There's a lot of Cubans. I will imagine now with all these Haitians and Cubans coming in, there will be lot of that. Matter of fact, I think the growers probably see this as another golden opportunity. We have another minority group to exploit. That's right. The way they exploited the Filipinos. The way they exploited the Indians. And I'm saying the Indians from India. The way they've done recently with the Puerto Ricans. They get them, and the theory of divide and conquer has always been one of the way they work. They keep the people fighting against each other. But within the farm worker movement, we have the Filipinos. As a matter of fact, Delano, I'm sure you've all heard of that, have heard of the movement, is now a retirement village for Filipino workers. The reason for this is there was a state law in California that forbade the immigration of Oriental women into the state. For a long time, it was Oriental. But originally, they allowed the Oriental men to come in because they needed them for agricultural work, for building the railroads, building the canals. But they wouldn't let any women come in. So you have thousands of Orientals down there that had no women. You have a lot of bachelor Orientals down there. So anyhow, at any rate, Delano is now a Oriental, Filipino retirement village. Again, our racism. I've already mentioned the agribusiness on the state level. Now, $4.8 billion. Got to tell you something. What can a group who wants something do? They literally own the land of the state. They own the politicians. Anything they want, they get a good shot at. They own the banks. So California is agribusiness. Probably, then after you get away from the individuals, the large individuals like the Gallos, the Giammaras, you get into corporate farming. And it's a funny thing that what's happening in California is that the number of farmers is getting smaller, but the size of the farm is getting larger. So you've got these large corporations down there crying the blues to the state that they need more irrigation. So the state will run down a few million dollars worth of irrigation to them. Get probably good example is the United Brands or Chiquita. You're all aware of that Chiquita boycott we had. They go on through, you get United Brands, but they own not only large parcels of land all over the United States, they own large parcels of land in Central and South America. They own shipping companies. They control everything from the ground on through the consumer. Therefore, they control the price. Same thing is happening in our domestic markets, where they own everything from the seed on through the store to the consumer, the packing houses, the canneries. So there is no competition. And that's when they try to lay this stuff on you about, well, our large increase in wages is what's causing these large increases in prices. That's not quite the truth. What's causing the increase in prices is because they have no competition, consequently they can charge what they want. And they also get the profit in between each step. They get the profit in the planning, in the processing, in the packing, in whatever packing, in the transshipment. So it's just one big profit picture. And a lot of you are aware of the oil industry, Shell, Exxon, all trying to get into the agriculture business. Then they'll really have it all, because the fertilizers and all the chemicals that they use on the farms are produced by your large oil companies. When the union finally got going and started learn how to play the game, like I said, Caesar started from nowhere. This was belief and faith and trying to attract people to work with him. Okay, they got into the corner of politics, and then when they started playing politics in California, learn how to play the game, that is when they started to get some relief from the state agencies and the county agencies. Let's see. Probably the last big thing that happened is the ALRA, the Agricultural Labor Relations Act, which was passed in California. Now, this was supposedly to allow the workers in the fields to give them some protection, both from the unions and from the growers. And however, as it turned out, it was sponsored by the UFW, and it got worked out between meetings with the UFW, the growers, even the Teamsters were involved there. And let's see. But okay, it gave the workers a lot of protection. But what has happened? This was passed not by vote of the people, but through the legislature. But what has happened is that it has been such a good tool for the farm worker that now the growers are intent on gutting the ALRA so that it takes away all what help that it has given the farm worker. It wants to take it away. They want to take away their union shop rights, something that all of the unions take for granted, and of course is protected under the for other unions under the National Labor Relations Act. They just keep picking at it, and want to destroy it, so that in the end all they will have is just a title left, just a shell of what the intent was. I mentioned the Teamsters. What happened in the Teamster thing was we had the contracts with the growers. But when the contracts were getting ready to terminate, the Teamsters came in the back door, sat in smoke-filled rooms with the growers and wrote out a sweetheart contract. Essentially what it said was, okay, you will be the representative and we'll recognize you. The people in the fields didn't have a vote or say one way or the other of whether or not they liked the contract. Okay, at this point, there was a declaration of war between the Teamsters and the UFW. And Caesar had, UFW had the people. And the growers got caught in the middle of their own machinations, because when the strike was called, it was a result of their own doing. They could have honored or renegotiated the old contracts instead of going in the back door with the Teamsters. But they chose not to do that. They did not want anything to do with UFW, because they knew that UFW was in fact representing the people, where the Teamsters were representing the Teamsters. And essentially what happened in the end, because of the ALRA, is that when elections were held in the farms for the farm workers, it was like 5 times out of 6, the farm workers would go with UFW. So it just proved what Caesar had always said, is that, okay, you got the contract, but we got the people. And so Teamsters have bowed out now, except for what they always had, and that was the canneries and the packing workers.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
About, were there farm workers that were already members of the Teamsters union?
Well,
the
Teamsters just went in and made agreements with the growers.
And said that we would get the people together?
No. They didn't do nothing.
Okay.
You're a grower and I'm a Teamster. A bargaining agent. We go back in the corner here. Let's say all these people in here are farm workers, huh? Okay. But you and I go back in the corner here and make an agreement, a contractual agreement. Okay. And then I come out, or you come out as the grower and say, okay, you guys are all Teamsters now. And that's essentially what it was.
So that if you want to work at all, you have to be part of the Teamsters union.
If I happen to have the union shop clause in the contract, yeah. And that is, they did have it. Yeah.
Where did they get the people from, though? If the people, the broad base of people were supporting UFW, where did the Teamsters get their manpower to honor the contract?
Well, okay, let us say, for instance, the same situation. She's the grower, and I'm the bargaining agent, and you are all farm workers. And you are all UFW, okay, and if you haven't signed the card, at least you're sympathizing. But we don't tell you that we're going to bargain. We just go ahead and make an agreement between us two. And yes, it was legal.
So that since you had essentially a closed shop, that if you wanted to work at all, you had to join the Teamsters union.
Right.
Okay.
With this particular grower.
Okay. I was confused
about that. Yeah. Well, that was a very confusing issue. And, of course, the growers made the most of it, because during the boycott, they were saying this is a jurisdictional dispute. They were innocent, but it was of their own making. I can't get away without talking a little bit about the media. Media coverage, what little there is probably about 95% bad and 5% indifferent. I recall when they had those year, last year, when they had those 30 or 40 KKK guys marching to Selma, and they had about four nights of it on TV. Well, during that same period of time, in California, there was 15,000 people marching in Salinas. And how many people here heard a word about it? In February of last year, there was just about 8,000 people on the Capitol steps. And I was in California at the time, and we got about 3 minutes of local coverage on the Sacramento station. There was nothing in Los Angeles, nothing in San Francisco. And this was over the part of the issue where they tried to gut the ALRA. And however, when there was violence, it was splattered all over the papers. We got when we had unfortunately one of our pictures was killed in California. We got the news up here for about 2 days on that. It was about a minute's worth. But it showed the violence. It said very little about the man who was killed and under what circumstances. So, and it seems that now, this last year has been kind of declared an open season on farm workers. How many of you saw that primetime show that they had last year on farm workers? Good. I'm glad to see that. But the thrust of it was that UFW had taken millions of dollars from the government under grants and had nothing to show for it. The reality is we got about $100,000, which amounted to about one-tenth of the total cost of one project. And that was the only monies that had any government strings attached to it. So what I'm saying is that then Jack Anderson here ran, how many of you read those Jack Anderson columns here last February, March, okay. Now, there's a man with several million readership, and I liked one of his statements. Mark can appreciate this because he was in La Paz. It says that Caesar ran his empire from La Paz with an iron-fisted hand. Which, you know, all you can say is that it's a lie. It really, for those who don't know Caesar, you probably have to take the word of people like Mark and myself who do, he's just not the iron-fisted tyrant that, that they tried to. Like, I don't know who you can compare him to, you know, maybe a lamb or what have you.
He had the smallest, gentlest hands I've ever seen.
Been out of fields too long.
I have a question about the media. Do you think, do the growers have a lot of like control over the media, or is it just that there aren't people in the media that are sympathetic at all, or ignorant?
No, there are a few sympathetic, but the large part is the money, the grower money.
The growers have money.
They own, like I say, they own the state. Mm-hmm. Except the thing that they don't own is the people. They'd like to. Now, I'm going to skip a lot of this. I've mentioned La Paz, which I says originally was to be a retreat where they could go and kind of recuperate. See, we're talking about, I'm going to read these off, sure, why not? La Paz is the administrative headquarters, okay. And this is where we get into the business aspects of the union. From La Paz, we have our legal department, negotiations, budget, contract administration, which is another ball. See, once you get a contract with a grower, see, that doesn't mean a whole bunch. You have to get out there and make sure that they're going to do what the contract says. And that's a whole different ballgame in itself. We have our some of those unheard of things. We have the pension plan is administered from there, the medical plan. Can you imagine farm workers with an honest to God medical plan? You know, their families can go to a doctor and say, yeah, you know, I got a card. We have a credit union. The cause of the prime time show are microwave control down there. We have our service center, which the service center owns the union properties. Okay. We have our Campesino Center administrator down there. Our Campesino Centers are kind of an offshoot of the CSO activities. Now, CSO is a social program organization that help people in need. Okay, now the Campesino Centers do about the same thing. They help people with their taxes, they have any problems with the local bureaucrats, they help people emergency aid. But okay, that's what we're called. And we have at this point 22 active, and plans for expansions into Oregon, Washington, Arizona, and Texas. We have our accounting office down there. So, okay, that's our administrative headquarters. And the people that are there are just a bunch of dedicated individuals. They work for $10 a week plus room and board. Work 6 days a week from 8 in the morning to 6 in the evening. And there's just not too much you can say for them. You always kind of feel like you're saying too much, but you can't. You have the type of dedication that allows you to do the job for the sake of doing the job. And for the compensation, knowing that you're helping somebody, and somewhere down the line, somebody is getting some reward from what you're doing. Just before I left down there, we had a crisis, and every day is a crisis, Mark. And we're very crisis-oriented. But we had our legal secretaries were working. They finally had to go on 24-hour basis. They worked 3 days, and were working 8 hours on and a couple hours off and another 8 hours around the clock to prepare some legal briefs that were very necessary. It's hard to believe that people will do it, and nothing against the group. I mean, I'm not talking about 1 or 2 months. I'm talking about year after year after year. Eventually, people get tired, and some drop out. Occasionally, they come back. Most often, they don't. So there's always a need for good, qualified help, willing to dedicate yourself. But I want to get to the nonviolence aspects. Now, it's easy for us to say, yeah, it should be nonviolence. Yeah, that's the only way to go. Yeah. We can really say it. But could you say it when you're sitting in a picket line or standing in a picket line and you got some big cowboy grinding his high heels into your instep, or you're being attacked by a 2x4, or you see a spray plane come by and lay some pesticide on you? A little bit different situation. Can you say it? Can you really practice nonviolence when your wife's been hit over the head with a big billy club, or your husband's sitting there being choked, or when you see your friend, your husband, being shot? I don't think any organization sets out to build itself on martyrs. I mean, not even the Christian church set out. But, you know, we end up with a martyr every year. We've got three martyrs that we certainly cherish their memory. We memorialize them every year. But, you know, that's not where it's at. Caesar got his principles on nonviolence, he claims equally, probably from his mother, who always preached turn the other cheek, and then from his readings from Gandhi. Dedicated enough to nonviolence that there was this one instance where this black belt karate expert attacked one of the pickets. Well, this picket had the audacity to protect himself with an iron pipe and broke the karate expert's hand or arm. When the word got to Caesar that this had happened, Caesar said, "Kick that man off my line. We don't want him." I'm going to read a little quote from Caesar here. "Our struggle is not easy. Those who oppose our cause are rich and powerful. They have many allies in high places. We are poor. Our allies are few. But we have something the rich do not own. We have our own bodies and spirits, and the justice of our cause is our weapons. When we are really honest with ourselves, we must admit that our lives are all that really belong to us. So it is how we use our lives that determines what kind of men we are. It is my deepest belief that only by giving our lives can we find life. I am convinced that the truest act of courage, the strongest act of manliness, is to sacrifice ourselves for others in a totally nonviolent struggle for justice. To be a man is to suffer for others. God help us be men." Well, an hour is up now, and I'm willing to stay here, field questions if you want. Anybody who'd like to leave, sure. More than...
I want to know about, I'm kind of curious about sort of the effectiveness of the boycotts over the years. And if boycotts are going on, how people would find out, you know, what kind of products are being boycotted.
Okay, the effectiveness of boycotts over the years, we got the contracts. During the Great Boycott, to show you how things work, when it first started, they were getting about a half a pound of table grapes per week per man for the servicemen of Vietnam. When we got into the boycott a couple of years, they were buying 16 pounds per week per man. This was through the federal, through the Defense Department, through the Pentagon. So that made us think that possibly there might be a collusion with yours. We were never really able to do anything about that, but it takes care of itself. The boycott on the grapes went international. Okay, and when Caesar and Richard were in England, the day that they got there, they were all out on the docks, and they informed the union there that that particular ship had Caesar and
we're
Richard,
on the dock. Okay.
Yeah,
right.
Informed the union that this particular ship had grapes on it, boycotted grapes, and they refused to unload it. And so they sent it to another harbor, and they refused to unload it there. And they figure it ended up somewhere down in Italy being as wine grape or something.
Is that as British workers that were supporting it?
Right. Oh. They went, they had tremendous support everywhere they went, all over Europe. So this is, see, this type of thing really puts the crunch on the growers. And because a lot of our farm produce is overseas product. Okay, how to find out what is being boycotted at any given time? Today, Bruce Church products, which is mostly the Red Coach lettuce, is what is on boycott at this time. What has happened with Bruce Church, they've got the East Coast all tied up. There's very little, if any, moving up there. So what they've done, they are now looking for new markets. We got a friend of ours in Minnesota advised us that they were selling in Minnesota. When we first started the boycott, there was no Red Coach lettuce in Washington or Oregon. I suspect they are now trying to open markets here. But, of course, this is a hardship on the grower, because they're going into areas where there are probably already established producers. So, it tells us that the screws are tightening down on them. And they, Bruce Church people have been on strike now for 16 months. It has cost the union about $3 million. Now, besides our boycott, we have boycott people in most major cities in the United States: New York, Chicago, Boston, New Jersey. Detroit, anyhow, like I say, most major cities we have boycott houses. There are $3 million, but we're paying the strikers $25 a week, and but they've been strong enough to stay with us for a year and a half.
And, can I just say something? Another thing that keeps that price down, I mean, $3 million for 60 months is not bad. Through all the churches, they collect food to send to farm workers, families who are on strike, so that helps keep it down. So that's something that people do.
Well, yeah, well, I was going to ask, $3 million sounds like a lot. So $3 million is a lot, but when you spread it out amongst several thousand workers, it's not hardly anything at all. The end effectiveness of the boycott is okay. Will we get a contract? We feel at this time that they are hurting bad enough to perhaps warrant sit down negotiating a contract. To find out what is being boycotted at any given time depends on where you are. If you're where there is a United Farm Worker person available, you just call the office, or else at any time you could call or write to the office in La Paz.
You mentioned it's a brand name for lettuce, right?
Red Coats lettuce.
Different kinds of lettuce. I mean, it isn't like all one kind of lettuce.
Red Coats, Bruce Church is iceberg lettuce. It's the head lettuce.
Okay.
Of course, it doesn't hurt either. Or my own particular thinking is that if you stop buying all lettuce. You know, the pressure from the other growers gets to them anyhow, because they have a little help me, I'll help you next time.
Sure.
Type rain and salsa.
The reason I was asking was, if you walk into a supermarket in the produce department, chances are you can't find out unless you ask.
Yeah, that's right. What you do, you ask.
They have a little taquito label on them.
Yeah, what you do is you ask the produce manager, what brand lettuce they're selling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I have an organizational question I want to ask, but I have to build a little story first of all. With industrial workers, a union can guarantee that they will negotiate for a set number of people in a factory, 1,000 people, 100 people, whatever their employment figure happens to be at the time of negotiation. Now, you spoke earlier about the fact that Puerto Ricans are coming into Florida, and now we have new Cubans entering Florida and so on. Will it be the policy of your farm workers to try to recruit those people, because obviously the growers are going to turn to them? How can you go to a prospective member of the union and say, here, we want you to join the United Farm Workers because we want to protect your interests, when it is possible that you'll have on the local rolls 4, 5, 10 times as many people as will ever be employed in Florida?
Well,
how can you convince a man that joining the union is going to be advantageous to him when you can't guarantee him a job?
What we're doing, you don't go out in the streets and hustle members.
No,
you go to a farm or a group, a farm group, and say, you meet with the people, okay, the workers that work there. Okay, now explain to them, ask them what they need, because it comes from them. Okay, then show them what you have accomplished in other places. In California, it's no secret. You can talk, because actually, you might be talking to the same guy in Northern California that talked to in Southern California a month previously. So it's all pretty well known. Okay, we're not going out into other areas and trying to hustle more members. It's hard enough handling what we've got now.
But
by the same token, you see, we'll say that in Florida it takes 10,000, whatever it is, 100,000 farm workers to handle the annual harvests in Florida. Now, you have 50,000 new Cubans have entered the market. Not all of them are going to be doing farm labor, but a certain number of them will be available to the growers. The grower says to these new Cubans, these new Puerto Ricans, none of whom are organized in your group,
okay,
come and work for us.
And they go.
Okay, and they go.
Okay.
Then you go to them and you say, here, join our union.
No, but if we already have a contract there, see, that would make a difference.
Well, whether you have a contract or not, you already have the people to cover the work in Florida. You see?
Well, no,
it's like the factory that has 1,000 people. They have 1,000 union members. But they're not going to go outside and try to organize beyond 1,000. But you have to protect yourself if you have the contract for 1,000 men, if that's what the grower
does. No, see, it holds the same. If I have a contract with a grower, see, and he draws in non-union members, see, to do my people's work, then we will strike them. Mm-hmm. And those people in there will be scabs. And essentially what we'll do is try to convince them that they should come out of there. It's not an idea of keeping them out, it's just convincing them they should come out of there.
What if he doesn't have a UFW contract? What if he just goes out and hires?
What I'm saying is that right now we wouldn't be in that position. So that maybe something would come to, you know, in the future.
What are your feelings towards illegal migrant workers up to California and the Washington area? How do you deal with that?
The illegals?
Yeah.
Well, that's a federal problem.
So
what happens? As a matter of fact. It is a problem for our people. Many of them that are here illegally are members of the UFW. Okay. If you can convince a man that he is being exploited for whatever reason, then and he is willing to go off the job to gain his rights, then no. There's no problem. When the growers bring them in and exploit them and purposely go out seeking them, what have you, see, then it's kind of a horse of a different color. See, but like I say, you know, the illegals is a problem. If they're member illegals, then they're less of a problem. I'd like to mention that we do have a very large medical clinic where we service our members in Mexicali.
Mexicali is a town in Mexico. I don't know.
Oh, okay, right. It's just right over the border. And
Well, do you ever deal with, okay, like say the union brings in braceros to take the place of, not the union, but the growers brings in Mexican people, not citizens, to work in the places that should be held by union people? Do you ever deal with that problem by turning those people over to the immigration office? Because it seems like that would be a huge temptation.
It's not our job.
So you just go in then and try to convince those people that they should become members?
Well, they should walk off the job and become members.
What's the annual income of a farm worker?
Well, it would vary, of course. I'm sorry, I don't have this figure on top of my head, but it was... Or recently researched, but it was about 5,000 last I heard. Do you know, Mary, off the top of your head?
I don't know
what it is. Now, again, we're talking the annual average, you know, and we're talking about $5,000, which is substantially below the poverty level. But there are now some people under contract getting $6-7 an hour. And these are machine operators, somewhere where you figure it should be. Like I said way back a while ago, that there's still a lot of farm workers in most of our southern states, well, most of the United States, that are not union members. See, I threw a figure out there of 1 million. And I think at the high, UFW was at about 48,000, somewhere in that area. And when we had the Teamsters troubles, got way down low, dangerously low. And the only thing that kept that union together was a lot of faith and a lot of real hard work.
Is the UFW active in Washington?
We have a Lupe in Sunnyside. We're not actively organized, but actively inactive, you might say. We expect that we may be opening a casino center, because we do have members that come up from California pears, and then there's a lot of people going to Oregon for the cherries, the apples, what have you down there. So we do have members up in this area. I mentioned the microwave system, and what that is, it is a radio telephone system where we have leased mountaintops throughout the state, and we can call from one end of the state to the other and keep in contact with all our campesino centers without the horrible telephone bills. We can go, I believe he has it hooked up now from Marysville. We can clear Cleanout down to Calexico. And from La Paz, or La Paz is is located between Bakersfield and Tehachapi, California, just in the foothills there of the Sierra Nevada range. So even from the whole valley, so essentially we're covered up, plus Southern California, with that microwave range. Of course, like I said, United Brands, the fresh picked Purex Corporation. We own fresh picked. Let's see. The guy who wine, Shanley.
Gallo is owned by Shanley?
No, so Gallo Wines is the company, the Gallo Brothers. But they own, real large parts of the state. They're a large corporation. They're a large company. But you're asking specifically about corporations. I say Chiquita, Bruce Church, Purex, Coca-Cola, and that's the Sunkist label. I can't think of any others off the top of my head.
Doesn't Exxon, Exxon owns a lot of mine, and Bank of America owns a lot of good farms in California?
Well, see, of course, I'm a little paranoid about the oil companies, because they control so much of our lives. They've got practically a monopoly on the energy sources of the United States. They've got all the coal, all the shale oil. As a matter of fact, I believe it was Shell recently bought controlling interest of the largest photovoltaic cell manufacturer in the United States. Now, those are the little cells that take the electricity out of the sun, the photovoltaic cell. So they're not going into it whole hog, but they're getting into it. And oil companies have bought into large tracts of land, and were real heavy in Mexican agriculture. So, like I say, I'm very paranoid about that. But this is things that I have to deal with, and you know, things that I guess the union is dealing with. But all these things I'm saying is, you know, here we go right back to where we started with Caesar, where, you know, what has happened, you know, is that here the man started with nothing. Nothing but his dreams and his goals and his faith, not only in himself, but I guess in the people and in the American people. And in the faith that they would respond. And we do have what has been accomplished. You know, if nothing, I would say if nothing else, a lot of recognition that, you know, by God, you know, farm worker is a human being. He's not a simple little peon with a low IQ out there, you know, grubby. You know, he's a man of dignity, man with skills that should be paid for.